Let's get started. This is 8:31 a.m. and I'm calling the Complaint Screening Committee of the Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
All members are present. We have quorum.
Thank you. So just really quick, I think Dr. Stewart has a previous commitment in a few hours, and I have a hard stop a few minutes before 11 a.m., so I'm going to be pretty brisk in today's meeting. I wanted to give some important preliminaries, but before we do that, let's go to the approval of the minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of the June 21 Complaint Screening Committee?
And I just want to note that Dr. Stewart is recused from this as he didn't attend the last meeting.
Thank you. So I'll make a motion to approve the minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion carries. So in terms of important preliminaries for all those in attendance, the Complaint Screening Committee, according to ARS Section 32-2081H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee will not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website, according to ARS Section 32-2081, subsection H1. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda, according to ARS Section 38-431.03, subsection A2, to review confidential records, or under subsection A3, to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Ms. Galvin. For those in attendance, please keep in mind that I reserve the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based on the parties that are present. Please only use initials for the patients, children, and the complainant. Keep in mind that the content of many of these records is confidential, and the content should not be disclosed in a public meeting. Keep in mind that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee of up to 3 minutes, only when prompted by the chair, which is me. Additionally, the licensee or respondent who is the subject of the complaint will also have a chance to make a brief 3-minute statement, only when prompted by me. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after the statements are made. So please keep in mind that only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant, the respondent, and the respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from anyone else, it will make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance, please keep your audio on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, and their legal representatives may unmute themselves and speak at that time. Please keep in mind that individuals in attendance who speak out of turn without the committee's approval will be warned twice by me not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. So with those important preliminaries in mind, I want to thank our staff for helping us prepare for this meeting. I know it's hard work for everyone. We have looked at the record in detail. So let's proceed with the first complaint on the schedule to review case number 22-31 for Robert Mastikian. Dr. Malott, since you are the lead, would you please get us started?
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. This is complaint number 2231 regarding Dr. Mastikian. I hope I'm saying your name correctly, Dr. Mastikian.
Yes.
Okay. And he received his license from our board in 2014, graduated from Argosy in 2011. A complainant was filed by the mother on behalf of her 22-year-old son regarding a claim for disability. Because medical diagnoses are confidential, I won't mention the specific diagnosis, but the board members, as well as Dr. Mastikian and the mother, are aware of it. So the mother, it is important to note, does not have conservatorship or guardianship for the 22-year-old son. The the son had filed for SSA, Social Security Disability, and needed an assessment, and Dr. Masterkian was asked to do that. Dr. Masterkian did a brief report during the assessment. He spoke to the mother, son, and indicated that the reason for the assessment was not really going to fly because of some of the other mental health issues that the son was experiencing. Eventually, the claim was denied by SSA. There were four reports used. So Dr. Masterkian's report was one of the reports that was used to that led to the denial. Part of the whole SSA assessments is that it's very confidential. Dr. Masterkian doesn't have access to the other reports. He kept checking the portal, but none of the other reports were available. He based his report on his own assessment and did express grave concern over the functioning and other related matters that the son was experiencing and recommended intervention for the other matters. There were several reports that we had access to, and I had a chance to read them, and it was very interesting reading those reports as they talked about the different diagnoses and mentioned certain factors that really maybe provided strong evidence, but other factors that did not provide evidence. You know, when you have differential diagnosis, you see that often case where other things can cloud the diagnosis for a certain condition and vice versa. The SSA, again, you know, there is, the mother does not have access to the reports. They were requested, but it is the property of the SSA office, and Dr. Masterkian did not share the reports per se with the mother. The mother has filed a complaint. Dr. Masterkian responded with his response. We received all of the information, and we are here to investigate whether there was any violation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Malad. So I see that the complainant DM is present. So if you will kindly unmute yourself, you may only identify yourself by initials, and you have 3 minutes to make a statement.
Good morning. Thank you for seeing me today. My son will not be attending. He changed his mind. So my concern is that, and you have all the information, we were unable to get Mr. Ginn's report. Up until this point, Social Security denied us, even with records releases. And they, in fact, actually told me, do not apply for conservatorship or to be his legal guardian until after his first denial, in which everything with Mr. Mastikian had gone on. Now, we were there for 35 minutes, and he did not do a report. I actually asked him, do you have any of this person's reports? He told me he had not gone over them. They're in his office. Basically, and I feel like, well, I gave him all of our information, and he came out 30 minutes later and was like, oh no, this isn't going to fly. He did not do an eval. I have two other evals with recommendations and all the testing starting at age 7 and 8 that totally says there's these issues, and we were denied disability. Now we're being denied, well, we're not being denied yet, but we're waiting for my husband's Social Security to come through because he committed suicide. We've had 3 family suicides, and he was not concerned about this, and he did not do the eval. Disability would not, I was there at Social Security a couple times in July. I was told the paperwork with the denial was blank. And then in the beginning of August, there was notes added to that report. And she was actually going to give me the report, and I have her name and her information, and her boss told her, no, we cannot get involved in this. So Social Security is paying a person to do a report that was not done. And I feel like Mr. Mastikian, I mean, he was not concerned. We did not get an evaluation. The whole point of the complaint is to understand why we are not getting, you know, an evaluation. Just because he spoke with him for 30 minutes, that's it. You're fine. On your way. I've been fighting for my son for a very long time, and I understand it says in the reports that it could be missed because my son is good at hiding things. So I feel like we were really wronged, and that was it. That is why we filed a complaint.
Thank you, DM. Let me see if any of the committee members have any questions to ask you at this time.
DM, thank you so much for being here. I know this has been very, very difficult, you know, this whole process of applying. Could you maybe talk a little bit more in detail about the, just you showed up for the meeting, you and your son, and you met with, I'm assuming there was information shared. So that happened before Dr. Mastakian spoke with your son. Can you just give some of the, you know, kind of the timeline, what happened when?
Well, okay, so I turned in both the reports, and he actually had me fill out paperwork when I got there. I think there were two packets, large packets. In fact, his packets were impressive. I was like, oh, wow, this, I've never been asked this before. So I did it thoroughly, and I was almost completed with the second packet. And he had taken W into the back and was talking to him. And I actually heard him say, so where's your father? You know, just being polite. And he was very polite the whole time. And my son was like, he committed suicide. And that was the last I heard. 35 minutes later, he comes back out and he says this isn't gonna fly. So my son and I stand there and proceed to talk to him, and I try to keep my temper because, you know, I don't want to make a scene and I don't want to upset my son more. And so I literally went back, I called our caseworker or the person that was involved or in charge of the case and told him what happened, and he said, don't worry, we do it on all the evals. And then we were denied a couple weeks later, and that claim has actually been pulled because they filed for my son's benefit, or for my husband's benefits for my son. That's a whole other thing. But that was it. And we literally cannot get records. And it took me a long time. I have issues of my own. So I could not get the report in. And then I had to go back and forth. I'm working, et cetera. So I've tried to get the information, but it wasn't there up until, you know, August, when she said, no, this report is there now. They added notes. And I went, I thought they couldn't do that. So up until I think the 14th of July, his report was blank. And there's emails with the board or with Ms. Michelson saying that, you know, this is blank. She stated it three times, et cetera. And that was it.
Okay. Thank you, DM. Appreciate that information.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any further questions for DM at this time from the committee members?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. DM, do I understand correctly that your son still has not been awarded Social Security disability benefit?
That is correct, yes.
Has there been another evaluation scheduled?
No. We were denied, and in fact, in June, I had called to find out what was... So we did an appeal right after we got the denial. And that's when I started working on the complaint. And this is the gentleman, his name is B, that works at the office. He dropped the ball. He admittedly was like, oh my God, I'm sorry this never got put in. They wanted to go retro. He wanted the paperwork to go retro, file for my husband's benefits, and then do W's complaint or, you know, file for the disability after he was awarded my husband's benefits. So they pulled it, and we didn't do the appeal. That actually got pulled. So now we're waiting on that. And I've called several times. They're waiting for another company to make a decision. My son, he was actually denied SMI due to what I believe the report, you know, being blank, there was not enough information. So we've not gotten those at all. In fact, they won't even answer my calls most of the time. They're really busy. So, but they've been very nice, just not on this particular thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again, DM, for being here. Any further questions? Hearing none, let's see. We have Dr. Mastikian, and I see your attorney, Dr. Akins, is present. Good morning. Thank you for being here. At this point, if you'd like to introduce yourselves, you may do so and make a brief statement, and then I'm sure we'll have questions to ask you.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee. I'll simply let him introduce himself, and then I know he does have some comments for you he'd like to share. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Dr. Mastikian. Pleasure to meet everybody. Good morning. So I'm under the understanding that we have 3 minutes instead of, I was under the impression it was 5 minutes to do a statement. Is it 3 minutes or 5 minutes?
Well, you may make your statement. We'll see once we are close to the 3 to 5 minutes. I'm not a very, I'm not a big stickler on 3 to 5 minutes. I mean, okay. You may make a statement.
Okay, so I have like 5 minutes of a statement, but the majority of it, I think, I know Dr. Mellon already ran through in terms of the limitations of the Social Security Office and Department. I can briefly go over it again, but briefly in terms of my experience, I've been conducting psychological evaluations for Social Security Department for nearly 7 years. I've done psychological evaluations for the Department of Child Safety for adults and children, and I also do psychological evaluations for veterans who are applying for disability claims for the VA. I also do independent psychological evaluations for individuals trying to get connectivity with the Division of Developmental Disabilities. As Dr. Mellon already pointed out, I just want to review it again, that when a consultative evaluation is completed or requested by a Social Security office, you have to follow very strict parameters. I'm not allowed to review any documents that are provided other than what's provided by the department. I can't reach out to collateral sources of information. I'm allowed to do my own limited research regarding the issues in question regarding the claim. I can't accept documents from the claimant or the claimant's representative directly. They have to be submitted to the Social Security office. I can't release my information to anybody other than the Social Security office. I'm provided with a template of items that must include in my report, and I'm asked to answer very narrowly tailored questions regarding the individual's functioning and their work-related abilities and limitations. My report is just one part of the information that the department reviews and considers in the context of everything else that's submitted on behalf of the claimant. The findings of eligibility and ineligibility are not matters that I'm involved with, and I'm not asked to provide any opinions regarding legal matters. I did see the claimant, her son, on the 16th of 2021. He was 21 years old at the time. He was accompanied by his mother, who was not his legal guardian or conservator. When I saw the individual, the allegations of disability were clearly identified, but I'm not going to repeat them here because my understanding is you can't discuss medical diagnosis or conditions in open forum, but I'm willing to discuss them with you in executive session if you need to. When he did arrive, I told the mother that because he was not under legal guardianship or conservatorship, that he would have to complete the interview independently. I informed her that that's the policy of the department. I informed her as well that if he had any difficulties at any point during the interview, that I would, with his permission, reach out to his mother and ask some supplemental questions, but he had absolutely no difficulties during the interview. When we started the interview evaluation process, I discussed the purpose and parameters of the evaluation. I discussed the limits of confidentiality. I asked him if he had any questions. He had none. He signed the informed consent form. The evaluation began. During the evaluation, I asked him very specific questions about specific to the claimed allegations. Questions are primarily based on DSM-5 criteria and supplemented by questions from research from the CDC and the National Institute of Mental Health. During the evaluation, I had extremely serious concerns about his safety and his elevated risk for suicide based on what he reported, how he presented. I assessed him for safety multiple times throughout the interview, and he was deemed safe. He said he would reach out to his mother for help if he was overwhelmed by suicidality. prior to him leaving my office, I accessed the provider portal to determine what records were sent by the department, and none were sent over at the time. So I walked the claimant out into the interview room, out of the interview room to the waiting room where his mother was waiting. I shared very, very serious concerns about her son's safety and his elevated risk for suicide. She shared the same concerns. I advised her, please follow up with a psychiatric provider because I'm very concerned about where he's at right now, just for that additional support. So I told the mother that there was strong evidence to support the conclusion that his son's limitations were primarily due to his long struggles with mood, which he's been dealing with since age 5, probably age 6, if I remember correctly. I informed the mother that although there were factors of another condition that I did take note of, and there was some evidence of it, that I didn't, I believe there was much more evidence to suggest that his longstanding struggles with mood were causing the most amount of dysfunction on his life currently and raising serious concerns about his safety. I informed the mother, please follow up with the DCS or the Social Security Office case manager to see if they received the reports that she wanted me to review because I didn't have them. Approximately 2 weeks later, I started writing the report. I re-accessed the provider portal to see if there was any records available, and still nothing was available. I reached out to the case manager again. He could not be reached. I was under time constraints, so I decided to write the report and submit it. In my report, to clarify for the mother, with all due respect, I provided two diagnoses, which the combined effects I opined were causing significant impairment in his ability to tend to his basic and advanced needs outside and inside of an occupational setting, independent of supports. His condition was very severe. I was very concerned. I'm asked to provide a prognostic statement by the department, and I provided a very poor prognosis that he will be able to get any major improvements in his overall functioning anytime in the next 6 months. The evaluation lasted close to 90 minutes. Okay. The mother claimed that she was informed by the department that the evaluation would last 4 hours. That's not the case. The evaluations are scheduled 2 hours apart by the Social Security Department. I didn't tell the mother that the Social Security Department would not believe that her son was struggling with a condition which she thought was the biggest issue. Never said that. I did not tell the mother that her son does not have a mental health condition that could not be remedied by a medication adjustment. I did inform, it is my understanding that the claim was denied, then this complaint was filed after the claim was denied. It's my assumption that she believes that my report was instrumental in that denial. However, if she had a copy of my report, she would see that my report was very much supportive of disability. And she would have been able to determine that if she had received the report by going through the proper channels, but it sounds like she's been having great difficulties getting a copy of the report. But that's what I wanted to suggest or to explain.
Thank you, Dr. Mastichi. And let me see if the committee members have any questions for you or if Dr. Akins wants to follow up with the statement.
Dr. Akins?
No, I have nothing further to add to what Dr. Mastichi has offered to you.
Dr. Mastichi, I have a couple of questions. So the mother, DM, has indicated this blank report. Can you shed some light on that statement?
That's quite perplexing to me because I don't know what that means. And when I submit my report, the report was quite extensive. I believe 11 pages long. I submitted that report, and when it leaves my hands and it gets to the Social Security office, what they do with it and how it's processed is beyond me. I don't know what they do, but by all means, I want to assure the mother that it was a very strong report in favor of her son with a disability, and they have the report. I just don't understand what a blank form is, and they are adding notations. I don't understand that.
Thank you. And when you typically do these evaluations, the SSA evaluations, do you often do psychological testing?
When they request.
Who does the request?
The Social Security Office does the requesting, but they allow us a lot of flexibility to determine which tests are needed and which tests aren't. Okay. So when they receive the notification letter in the mail, they're very strict standards, and we can refuse to evaluate them if they don't come in with their necessary glasses, their hearing aids if they're required to wear them. Their medications have been properly medicated when they come in. When the notification indicates that evaluator may decide not to do some of the tests that are ordered and replace them with other tests that things are much more appropriate for the claimant.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Mr.
Of course.
Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, do I understand it correctly that you, in your report, you described a significant mood disorder and that you felt that it was a disabling condition to employment?
If we want to get into specifics of any diagnosis, perhaps we should go into executive session. I realize we're using initials, but I just want to be careful that we don't disclose too much on the public record.
Let me re-ask the question this way. Did you recommend the final recommendation was that the individual had a disability?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. But this was not the disability with which the mother initially felt that the son had?
I'm assuming that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Dr. Mastikian or Dr. Akins? Hearing none, let's go into deliberations. As a reminder, this is a time for the committee members to decide or discuss the case amongst themselves, so please no interruptions from the complainant or the respondent or their attorneys. Dr. Malat, since you're the lead, do you want to get us started with the discussion?
Yes. I think it is always difficult when SSA uses the information and makes a ruling that is not what, one hopes for. And there is an appeal process, and I know DM is and the son are pursuing that. However, I think Dr. Mastikian did do his expectation. He has, as he indicated, many years of experience doing these evaluations. He expressed grave concern over, some of the mood that the son was experiencing, and kind of did that duty to inform with the mother, making sure that the mother and the son access psychiatric help to address those, the SSA did have access to four different reports. And if you read through all of the reports, there are questions, which comes first, And so in my opinion, Dr. Mastikian, did his process. He wasn't able to release that information to the mother. We have a note from SSA indicating what his role is in the whole process. And it matches what was just shared with us right now. That's my understanding. I don't see any willful negligence, or it is not the outcome that the mother hoped to get. And in his report, he does indicate the problems, and that the son should be considered for the benefits, but it's another third party that is making that decision that is not under review by this board and wouldn't be under review by this board. So.
Thank you, Dr. Malad.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to concur with Dr. Malad. I think these are very emotionally very disturbing times that the parents can go through with adult children. And I think that it seems like that the licensee put forth a good effort to come down on the side of recommendation in responding to questions, recommendation of a disability. And so it was not what had been anticipated, perhaps, but I cannot find any fault with Dr. Nastikian's proceedings.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. And I am thinking along the same lines. I'm looking at our statutes, definitions of unprofessional conduct, and I'm not seeing any violation or anything that comes close to a violation of any of those definitions of unprofessional conduct. So is there a motion? I'm hearing that the committee is leaning towards dismissing this case. Is there a motion?
I'll go ahead and make the motion to dismiss the complaint.
I second that.
There's a motion and second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion carries. Thank you, DM, and thank you, Dr. Mastikian and Dr. Akins, for being here. Let's move on to the next case on the agenda, which is case number 22-28. For Luke Bigler, Dr. Malad, since you're the lead, would you please get us started?
Yes. Just give me one second. I want to open up the file.
Oh.
Jennifer, I know you added something to the portal this morning, but I haven't had a chance to look at that. So...
Yes, Dr. Malad, for the record, we received subpoenaed phone records late yesterday for Dr. Bigler's office number. It's a landline. So okay. I made a notation at the top of the file.
Okay, and I will look at I'll go ahead and do my brief summary, and then I will, you know, we will hear from the complainant and Dr. Bigler. So Dr. Bigler is a recent graduate. He graduated in 2020. He also sought SIPACT. And so he, as because of his SIPAC status, he's allowed to provide telehealth in other states. He did a pre-doc, post-doc, and his interactions with the client began when he was a post-doc in Minnesota. And then after he was licensed, he moved, or somewhere in that time, he moved to Arizona. The client requested to continue seeing Dr. Bigler, and Dr. Bigler agreed to continue seeing her via telehealth. During the course of the relationship, the client has had, different issues, some of it which has been treated through an inpatient setting, etc. There appears to have been a relationship beyond the therapeutic relationship that was starting to occur between client and the therapist. The client was warned on January 31st, 2022, that this is inappropriate. It is not part of a therapeutic professional relationship. The client agreed to kind of back off. And she was very, very interested and really appreciated the therapeutic relationship that she had with Dr. Bigler and did not want to lose that therapeutic relationship. So she said she was going to work really hard and not bring up kind of inappropriate comments, romantic thoughts, etc. On February 9th, 2022, there was another session, and some of this, and the client, you know, was very, I thought, reasonable and really showed care for Dr. Bigler's license status and indicating that she knows how important it is to be a psychologist in good standing and that she would work hard. And there was some texts exchanged. As far as I know, I think I could only read one side of the text. I could not see the responses unless I missed it in the, you know, over 600 pages of records we got. The session, we were also provided with the audio recording for the February 9th. We were provided with other audio recordings as well. The February 9th recording, the complainant indicated that we need to listen to it starting at a certain point, which I did. And I was concerned about the content of that conversation. I felt it crossed some lines. I then read the progress note, which, you know, when we have a chance to talk to Dr. Bigler, I really need to ask him some questions, because the progress note indicated it was an intervention. But during that 2/9/22 session, Dr. Bigler expressed a lot of concern about some of the interactions and that he's worked really hard to get where he is. And he was scared and he was afraid of losing his, you know, license, as he put it. And but he really trusted the client that some of that conversation wouldn't come to light. So this conversation went on. The session ended on February 9th. Dr. Bigler sent a note to the complainant indicating that he was terminating the relationship. Again, I'm a little perplexed, and I have a question for Dr. Bigler as to what happened between February 9th and February 10th, and I'm not certain. The complaint was filed. The complainant's husband was also involved in filing the complaint, and we are here today to really determine, was their relationship, were they ethical violations? And was Dr. Bigler out of his depth? You know, he is an early career psychologist. And you know, so I have a lot of questions regarding this case. So, and I'm going to pause there.
Thank you, Dr. Malat. So let's see. I see complainant KF present. So if you'll please unmute yourself, identify yourselves for the record.
And Chair Dinar, I'm sorry to interrupt, but KF is not the complainant in the case. The complainant is a third party. And so as Dr. Bigler's lawyer, I obviously have to object to KF participating, especially given that she was given opportunities by Ms. Michelson to participate more directly in this process and opted not to do that. And so typically I know the complaint committee's purpose is to talk to the complainant. The complainant is not present on this matter.
Thank you, okay. Mr. Perry.
Sorry, I should have added that too. Thank you for that. The initial complaint was filed by, so KF shared some of this with her therapist in Minnesota, this licensed social worker, who then filed the initial complaint. However, KF did provide a lot of the information that I referred to during this, my overview, which I think Ms. Galvin, if correct me if I'm wrong, we are allowed to take all of that information into consideration. Is that correct?
That's correct. I do believe that the complainant is present or no.
The complainant, JJ, is not present. I do see that KF is here. I do just want to note that she had initially contacted me and expressed wanting to file a complaint, and I gave her the information. However, she did not once that complaint was filed, I let her know that she could provide information to the board, which you do have in your file today. So it would be up to the committee to determine if they would like to hear from KF and if they have questions for her.
Thank you, everyone, for that additional information. Mr. Carey, I note your objection for the record, but I'm going to allow KF to speak and make a statement. So KF, if you'll please.
If I may suggest, because she would be treated as a witness in this matter, I would suggest you hear from Mr. Carey and Dr. Bigler first, if that's okay. Because they're the party.
Let's do it the way you suggest. So Mr. Carey, Dr. Bigler, if you would like to introduce yourselves, make a statement, and then I'm sure we'll have questions to ask.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Dinar, members of the committee. This is Flynn Carey, counsel for Dr. Bigler. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Ruth Bigler.
And Chair Dinar and Dr. Malott, some of the comments, actually a lot of the comments I have to make are directly related to KF's treatment, since I think it's kind of inextricably intertwined to this allegation. So I don't know if the board or the committee wants to move this into executive so I can get a little bit more detailed about her records. I want to be respectful of the patient, obviously, but I also, in order to provide the context, including some responses to what Dr. Malott expressed some concerns about, I didn't want to misstep here.
Mr. Dinar, members of the committee, it sounds like it would be appropriate to go into executive session, one for the purpose of receiving legal advice if you need it, but then to review confidential health information.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. So I'll make a motion to go into executive session to obtain confidential health information and, if necessary, legal advice as well. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 None opposed. So what we're going to do is we're going to go into a breakout room, I believe, and we'll invite Mr. Carey and Dr. Bigler committee members and, obviously, Ms. Galvin and our board staff.
That's correct. Thank you.
To the executive session.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
It would not be appropriate.
Open session, and this is still agenda item 4B regarding Dr. Bigler. So at this time, I want to ask Dr. Bigler if he has a statement to make in open session. If he has, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I have learned a great deal from this situation, and it has been a formative experience as I develop as a practitioner. When I first began working with KF, her presenting issues and treatment goals appeared relatively straightforward, and her progress appeared positive and mostly linear. Unfortunately, in the later fall, early winter months of 2021, the issues she was facing became more complex. As she began making progress, it's my opinion that she fell back on some of her her maladaptive coping strategies, including sabotaging productive professional relationships, including the professional relationships I had with her as her provider. She further created obstacles to care to her care by abandoning many of the support she had from others, despite my encouragement to nurture and develop those relationships. As the severity of her impairment and distress increased, her ability to cope and her support systems diminished, leaving me as a significant and at times her only support. With our sessions being exclusively virtual and with me being 1,000 miles away, this left me in a difficult position as an outpatient therapist. When KF started making inappropriate comments and attempted to cross boundaries, I attempted in response to validate, but also to reaffirm those boundaries. At times, KF seemed to understand, and in both her statements during session and in writing, acknowledged that I had warned her and that she needed to respect those boundaries I had set. At other times, she would double down on her boundary crossing. Ultimately, I attempted a more aggressive intervention to get her to see how untenable it would be to allow those boundaries to be blurred. She did not take that intervention, and upon reflection, I could have approached that situation differently. I did ultimately terminate her from my practice with an option for her to come back after a period of time. At that time, there was no way to keep her on as a client, given her ongoing refusal to respect boundaries and norms. At the same time, she had done a considerable amount of damage to her personal supports and relationships. So I felt a level of obligation to keep in contact with her until she ultimately was stabilized in an inpatient facility. Unfortunately, she viewed that as a way to continue the boundary crossing, and I had to fully, immediately, and permanently terminate her. While I disagree with the alleged unprofessional complaints KF made, I know that the emotional pain she experienced over the past many months has been genuine. And I want to acknowledge her distress and convey my sincere sympathies for her emotional turmoil. And while I do disagree with KF's recollection and description of the events that occurred in our work together, I do take these allegations and this board complaint very seriously. That is why I have taken many steps to learn from the errors that occurred while treating KF. And I have put into place a written plan to ensure those missteps will not be repeated in the future. In closing, I reiterate that every interaction I have with KF, in session, electronically over the phone, was done in an attempt to advance her treatment, and that every intervention used was professional in nature. My feelings for her never crossed the line from professional to personal. I'm available to answer any questions you have about this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bigler. Let's see if any of the committee members have questions to ask you at this time in open session.
I'm okay for right now.
Thank you, Dr. Mullah. Yes, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bigler, certainly I'm inviting you to look retrospectively at things. When would you seek consultation in similar cases, if you were presented with similar cases in the future, at what point would you seek consultation?
So I have, it's part of my written plan that I have now joined a monthly consult group, so that I have that set up in place. I did consult with a colleague earlier on. In retrospect, I would have followed up with that individual on a regular basis, and perhaps even consulted some additional colleagues to get other perspectives. I believe that additional consultation would have been quite helpful in this case, and it is something that I have learned from and have put into place to use in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Bigler. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. So at this time, I am thinking of entertaining a motion to hear from KF, who I want to remind everyone that KF is not the complainant. She was Dr. Bigler's client. The complainant was JJ, who is absent from today's committee meeting.
Committee Chair Dinar, I didn't know if it would be appropriate at this time prior to that, if you want me to make my comments or if you would prefer that I just defer. I can certainly defer until after you've had an opportunity to speak to KF.
I would prefer that we defer any comments you may have, because that way you'll have a chance to respond to whatever information we obtain at that point.
I appreciate that.
I move that we hear from KF.
There is a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Motion carries. So KF, if you can please unmute yourself. Want to remind you, please identify yourself only by initials, and you may make a brief statement, and then we'll see if any of the committee members have any questions to ask you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the committee and the board staff for giving me this opportunity to speak. It's a daunting experience, so I prepared my statement in writing. I wanted to respect the committee's time and keep it as brief as possible, but without removing the salient points, it comes to about 6.5 minutes. Can I have permission from the committee to read it in full?
Well, you may want to reduce the statement a little bit.
Okay, I'll try. First of all, thank you for listening to the February 9th session. If you'll listen to the January 31st session, in which Dr. Bigler claims that he put boundaries around my feelings, you will hear a very different story. You will hear there were no boundaries placed around my feelings, and you'll hear him encouraging me to talk about them and then thanking me afterwards for being so vulnerable. He said, quote, secrets keep us sick, and by not keeping that in the dark, you're not allowing that to sit there anymore. So thank you. Just wanted to add that real quick. Dr. Bigler and I had a clinically appropriate relationship for a little over a year before things changed. In the first couple months of the year, I went through an uncharacteristic period of heavy drinking. It brought about some unusual and upsetting events. He was ever present, and with each alcohol-induced crisis, I became more and more dependent on him. Alcohol did some scary things to me. I had never before, but one night after drinking a large amount, I suddenly developed a suicide. I was lucid enough to realize the danger, and I called Dr. Bigler.
I'm sorry, KF, you're sharing personal health information at this point.
Okay, well, let me skip that then. All right, so that emotional dependence evolved into what I now know to be erotic transference, which is, it can be a normal phenomenon. But instead of explaining that in an appropriate way and centering my clinical needs, Luke centered his own desires in his self-disclosure and preyed on a vulnerability. I was startled by what I was feeling for Luke. My confounding feelings of strong love for him were at times overwhelming. My sexual attraction towards him was discussed openly and often in our therapy sessions, as well as emails and messages, many at inappropriately late hours of the night. Luke consistently normalized my feelings and urged me to talk about them. He praised my willingness to be vulnerable and sharing. No boundaries were ever placed around my feelings, as was later claimed in my therapy records. In an attempt to untangle these puzzling feelings of sexual attraction, I devoted an entire session to a single traumatic event from my childhood. Am I able to elaborate on that?
Just in general terms, no sharing of personal health information in open session.
Okay. I was taken advantage of by my gymnastics coach. He allowed me to believe I was solely to blame, told me how much he trusted me to keep his secret, and I took that on as my duty. I loyally shielded him from facing the consequences of his predatory actions, protecting him from the police as well as the American Gymnastics Association. I told Dr. Bigler this whole story. Interestingly, it was the very next session on February 9th that Dr. Bigler disclosed his reciprocal romantic feelings using direct quotes. He said, "I'll share this with you because I do think it's in your best interest, because I don't want you to feel that this is some one-sided thing that you need to feel shameful for." He referenced a session from the previous summer as the starting point to his sexual thoughts about me. He normalized this by saying that as a human being, quote, "When we are interacting with people we find attractive, beautiful, we have thoughts." He said there had been times those thoughts had gotten out of control and he had to rein them back in. He said, quote, "I just want you to know that it's not all one-sided and it's not wrong to think that way. It's not wrong to feel that way." He then told me how much he trusted me to keep these conversations secret, reemphasizing that statement of trust several times. He asked me to delete all my messages on my chart on Simple Practice so that my husband wouldn't find them. I eagerly agreed. I would have done anything he asked. With my permission, he ultimately deleted the entire chart and started a new one, so there would be no record of our conversations. My husband caught on quickly to things between us, and he sent Luke a text that simply said, "Big mistake." After receiving that text, Luke turned cold and clinical, pretending to have never reciprocated my feelings, which was extremely confusing and painful for me. One day, I boldly attempted to rekindle the tone of the February 9th session by sending him a series of suggestive texts. Admittedly, not my finest moment. Luke responded with a long, morally superior text, chastising me for my inappropriateness and terminating our therapy, effective immediately, citing my inappropriate behavior as the reason. I was beyond devastated. I believed him that this ending was all my fault and that he had done nothing wrong. It has taken me a long time to understand that wasn't reality, but a cowardly setup to hide the wrong he did. As emotionally damaging as that was, it was nothing compared to getting my therapy records in the mail. I was shocked to read the slanderous false narratives Dr. Bigler had spun. Out of self-protection, he painted me as a crazy person, going so far as to use the word delusions. He even gave me an erroneous post-termination diagnosis in an attempt to discredit me. Thank God I was recording those sessions in order to retain what was discussed, as alcohol tends to strip memory. I never dreamed I would need to use these recordings for anything else. You can clearly see the discrepancies between what was actually said in our sessions versus what was described in my session and progress notes. Additionally, the dates of the electronic signatures and the dates they were written were sometimes weeks after the corresponding session dates. The date discrepancies, in addition to concrete audio proof of actual session content, is hopefully sufficient proof that Dr. Bigler has lied, plain and simple. Words cannot describe the sense of betrayal, the psychological destruction that resulted from reading these terrible lies about myself, written by the person I had trusted unwaveringly with my deepest vulnerabilities. I was completely blindsided. After everything that had happened, I somehow still believed Luke to be a man of integrity who would never, ever intentionally injure me. Those lies completely broke me. What Luke did was extremely harmful. He damaged my marriage, put my life at risk by not calling anyone that critical night, allowed me to attend sessions with full awareness of my intoxicated state, deleted medical records, created false records full of inaccuracies, and by his mercurial, deceitful actions, caused me severe emotional and psychological damage, which I currently work through weekly with a trauma therapist. I finally felt safe to disclose a childhood sexual trauma, and instead of offering clinically appropriate, safe, supportive care, Dr. Bigler decided to indulge his own personal and sexual interests, and this ultimately amplified my trauma and left me to clean up the pieces. Two trusted authority figures in my life verbally charged me with keeping quiet to conceal their misdeeds, both letting me take all the blame for the quote-unquote relationship, solidifying my silence. But these were not relationships. They were abuse, and they were not my fault. Both men had an obligation to keep me safe, and both used their position of power and knowledge of my vulnerabilities to exploit me. But I am not 16 years old anymore. I am an adult, and I have a responsibility to speak up to protect vulnerable females under Dr. Bigler's care, present and future. I will not keep his secrets. I have a voice, and I have spoken the truth. I ask that you hold Dr. Bigler accountable for his actions. Thank you.
Thank you, KF. Let me see if any committee members have questions to ask you at this time.
I had one question for KF. KF, you mentioned the February 9th session, and then you mentioned text after the February 9th session.
Yes, ma'am.
And the texts were from you to Dr. Bigler?
Most were from him to me. He asked multiple times how I felt about our session, what I was thinking about our session. And I answered, you know, that I was elated. I felt great, but I didn't know what else he wanted me to say. But he kept probing, and I, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So seeing no, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair Dinar. KF, thank you for being here. I appreciate that. What if you had to make a recommendation to this board, to this committee, what would your recommendation be?
At the very least, supervision for a year and ongoing additional training. Me personally, I would recommend revoking his license, but yeah, at the very least, supervision.
Thank you.
All right, so it looks like at this time, Mr. Carey, if you want to make a statement, and we'll see if any further questions come off of it.
Thank you, Committee Chair Dinar, members of the committee. This is a case, I think, in which licensee attempted to find a path for a challenging client and a client who had a demonstrated history of sabotaging treatment. It's a case where licensee charted the boundary issues and made attempts to address them, and in fact passed a polygraph confirming that everything he did was for a therapeutic purpose, including the February 9th intervention. Licensee did what he could to navigate the situation, facing the reality that if he was too quick to discharge, he would not only be reinforcing some of the cycles that were previously involved with client, but he also would put her at risk because of some of the conditions that she was facing acutely at the time of the February 9th situation. This is not a case in which licensee crossed a romantic boundary. The only evidence as to this is what the client has provided. And as the investigator had warned the board, the messages are subject to scrutiny. Remember, you don't have to take our word for it. The board investigator subpoenaed the records directly from Verizon, and they demonstrate that the text messages and the communications that KF and her husband have indicated were sent are not actually in those records. I can certainly, you know, the board can certainly question the modalities or the appropriateness of the intervention. Although we submit holistically, the overall treatment was appropriate. I listened to 10 hours of therapy sessions that were covertly recorded by KF without the licensee's knowledge. And the majority of the information in the sessions was routine and it was straightforward. If licensee was engaged in actual boundary crossing, there would have been some evidence in those 10 hours of audio of boundary crossing. There was not. In fact, I gave you a breakdown of our audio recordings in the June, in my June 14th letter to the board. And there was not only does the audio not support a claim that there was any romantic interest, there's actually support for the fact that licensee was continuing to validate the client, but at the same time setting boundaries. There are time-stamped charts in this case, and the one that the client specifically speaks to on January 31st, there's a contemporaneous time-stamped chart where the licensee goes into explicit detail of how he attempted to right the ship here, how he attempted to bring client back on board. He talked about her inappropriate dress, her inappropriate statements. He went into detail in that. And what I asked the board to think about is, if someone was attempting to engage in a romantic relationship, why would he consult another colleague and document the heck out of it in his chart? The reality is he would not do that. This was what I would say is I don't want to focus too heavily on the items that we've already covered. And I think the committee has asked the right questions and detailed questions about, but I do want to address some of the concerns about this intervention and the question of should he have sought additional guidance. Well, he has done that. He has obtained 34 hours of continuing education. Ms. Michelson, in her report, wrote 24 hours, and she was referring to the PBI course. There was also another 10 hours, which is in the materials, but I want to focus the committee on the PBI course. I think I'm assuming the committee members are familiar with it. It's essentially the gold standard for ethics and boundaries. The DO board and the MD board regularly refer people to that program. And Dr. Bigler mentioned many times this plan that ultimately came out of that education. If the board hasn't seen one of these, we did submit his, but it's a risk management tool that PBI explicitly develops for each individual who goes through the program. And it is essentially a tool that you use anytime you are faced with a ethical or boundary situation. It also talks about some global ways you can modify your practice to ensure that there aren't any ethical issues. I put people through PBI proactively all the time because it actually does arm them with a lot of great tools on how to manage these situations and how to develop an ethical decision-making model. The other thing that I think is important is he now is part of a consult group. I think the committee initially has to do some initial balancing of credibility. And I want to just make sure the committee is familiar with page 3 of the IR, in which relation to some texts provided by client and her husband, the investigator wrote that these are not clear, there's no clear evidence that these are actual correspondence from Dr. Bigler. When client first called Ms. Michelson, she tried to speak to Ms. Michelson woman to woman or off the record and did not want to submit her evidence. And on April 4th, she actually held back the fact that there was a termination of the relationship. We have concerns about some of the materials that were provided here. I will say that licensee turned over everything disclosable in his possession, including as soon as the question of these text messages came to front, we instructed or asked the board to subpoena the records. I think that is a clear indication that if Dr. Bigler was afraid of those texts or afraid of those messages, he would not be asking the board to start sending out subpoenas. And if you want to remove any further doubt, he did participate in a polygraph. And in the polygraph, he was asked two key questions. First, did he lie about his services being strictly therapeutic? And second, was the February 9th intervention anything other than therapeutic? And he passed a polygraph confirming that everything he did was therapeutic here. In closing, this is not an improper relationship case. This is not a boundary case. This is a case in which if the board believes that there are things for the practitioner to work on, we submit that that can be accomplished through non-disciplinary means. But we would also ask the board and the committee to consider the fact that he has done a significant amount of continuing education, including the most specific and most rigorous ethics course. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Any questions for Mr. Carey or Dr. Bigler at this time? Hearing none, let's go into discussion and deliberation. As a reminder, this is a time for the committee members to discuss the case amongst themselves without any interruptions from clients, licensees, complainants, and their representatives. So, Dr. Malat,
Mr. Dana, I'm sorry about this, but I have one more question for Dr. Could I ask that question?
Yeah, please.
Dr. Bigler, any time during the therapeutic session, did you discuss transference and how that works and impact on clients?
I apologize for my pause. I'm just trying to recall topics and sessions from quite a while ago. I know that KF and I discussed at great lengths the harm that could be done. She did discuss much earlier on in her treatments how she was attracted to individuals with similar characteristics, not only to my position as a mental health provider, but also some other things. I apologize, I'm not recalling specifically what she had said, but there were times when we did discuss how those feelings can come up. I was doing my absolute best to walk that fine line between setting boundaries, but also not trying not to help her go into that shame cycle that she had gone through so many times before and was very vulnerable and very high risk to spiral into once again.
Okay, thank you.
And I would just note, and I don't want to read anything, but committee member Malat, on LB0077, there's at least a reference to the intervention that was used once she made that disclosure that Dr. Bigler just mentioned. And if you look at the second to last line, he termed that in a way that is transference language. I don't want to.
I do recall that note. So
yeah, it's there. It's there, member Malat. It's just I think it's interwoven in a lot of the progress notes. But LB77 is one instance of him discussing transference in, I think, a little more user friendly terms.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Malat, do you want to get us started with the discussion?
Yeah. Okay. So, there's a lot of materials in this case, and trying to put it all together, listening to KF's side of the story, and then listening to both Mr. Carey and what Dr. Bigler had to say, as well as the records. I think Dr. Bigler, throughout the record and, did make reference and was very clear about the boundary issues and that that the crossing of it would kind of, they had to have a professional relationship. And at some level, I think KF did recognize that and really wanted to hold on to the professional relationship and try to work hard on keeping that kind of curbing some of our thoughts and feelings, but it would come out in several, we saw that in several instances. And that's hard. And Dr. Bigler would remind The intervention was kind of came as a surprise. Not as a surprise. I mean, Dr. Bigler was obviously trying to work on the situation, but, you know, listening to the session, it was very believable, you know, and that's why I had the questions that I did regarding the intervention. And then what happened, the text messages seemed congruent with what Dr. Bigler said and what KF reported. You know, how did you feel? What were you going? And then the termination. I think it is a difficult situation, especially for a new therapist, a new licensee. And what I would have hoped is that Dr. Bigler would have sought additional consultation. He did seek consultation. He did, but I don't know. I got the sense as he was a little bit out of his depth, and you know, real serious consultation was needed. So I am concerned. I don't know if it falls to a statutory violation, but I am concerned. Especially for an early career psychologist, you know, we are all taught about consultation and supervision, and kind of, you know, it doesn't end the day you get your license. So we are going to be constantly confronted with new situations, new problems, something that we haven't encountered, and we seek that, you know, to ensure that we're providing the best treatment possible. So I'll pause there.
Thank you, Dr. Malak. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Chair. I have to absolutely agree and dovetail with what Dr. Malak has just indicated. In similar situations, there is a specific call for transference-focused therapy. I think had that been recognized and done early on, perhaps we would not be here now. I think that psychotherapy is a gut-wrenching process. It's uncovering deep emotional injuries. The patient's vulnerable. I think Dr. Bigler attempted to steer the course of psychotherapy. I wish he had sought consultation specifically around some of the diagnostic impressions and specifically toward this transference-focused therapy. I'm very pleased that Dr. Bigler has completed the 24 hours plus 10 hours of continuing education, including of ethics. I really do not find any violations that I would refer on to the full board for action.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. So in terms of the concern that Dr. Malak mentioned, I'm hearing maybe the committee is thinking of a non-disciplinary letter of concern regarding consultation that Dr. Bigler should have done as regards to, you know, how to process this case, and maybe that would have changed the course of treatment and the sessions that Dr. Bigler scheduled with KF. So I guess, I mean, that's really my only concern from what I've heard and what I have reviewed in the records is the consultation, but I have to agree with our professional members on the committee. I don't see a violation of our definitions of unprofessional conduct. So is there a motion or a recommendation as to what to do with this case? Dr. Stewart?
I would move that the committee consider a non-disciplinary letter of concern addressing this, specifically the issue of consultation. I think that, again, those issues have apparently already been addressed with the 34 additional continuing education units, But I move that we have a non-disciplinary letter of concern.
I think Ms. Galvin has something.
Yeah, so that would be a recommendation to the board. The committee doesn't have the authority to issue that letter of concern. If you want a letter of concern, it would have to go before the full board. One way you could do that is make the referral, and in the interim, if Mr. Carey and Dr. Bigler are acceptable to that, we could enter into that letter of concern and present it to the board at a future meeting.
We would not object if that were the what was presented to us.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart, would you entertain a friendly amendment to your motion along the lines of what Ms. Galvin suggested?
Yes, Chair Dinar, I would.
Thank you. Then I'll second the motion. There's a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
None opposed. The motion passes. Thank you, everyone, for being here for agenda item 4B. Let's move on to 4C. And as a reminder, we have maybe about 40 minutes left for the meeting. I have to step out for a prior commitment at 11 o'clock. So let's move to agenda item 4C, which is, let me pull up the item, is for case number 22-27. Carol Mellon Sisal, I hope I'm saying that correctly. And I'm the lead on the case, so I'll provide the committee with a brief summary. I apologize, I need to pull up something. All right, so this is, so Dr. Mellon has been a licensed psychologist since 1979, and she currently maintains a private practice in Scottsdale, specializing in forensic cases.
Adriana, it's Mellon началось.
I'm sorry, please unmute, please mute yourselves if you are not speaking at the moment. So mother has been involved in a contentious custody proceeding with her ex-husband. And their daughter, who is now 12. The parents divorced in 2012. In 2016, Dr. Mellon was appointed by the court as a therapeutic interventionist and then reappointed in 2018 for a period. I'm sorry, whoever is not muted, please mute yourselves. This is not the time for you to speak. In 2016, as I was saying, Dr. Mellon was appointed as a court-appointed therapeutic interventionist. In 2018, she was reappointed for 1 year. Mother had petitioned to have a Russian interpreter assist her in all of the proceedings, including the appointments with Dr. Mellon. Dr. Mellon's therapeutic interventionist appointment ended in September of 2019. In 2020, the parents requested that Dr. Mellon provide co-parenting counseling, which she agreed to. Dr. Mellon met with the parents over the course of 24 months, off and on. She did not provide any counseling services to the daughter. In February of 2022, mother filed a complaint against Dr. Mellon, alleging that Dr. Mellon had prohibited the mother from taking daughter to see any other medical health provider unless mother obtained Dr. Mellon's permission or approval. So as a result, the mother claims that the daughter's mental health issues worsened and she had to be hospitalized multiple times. So that is the case before us. There are allegations regarding whether Dr. Mellon may have prohibited the mother from taking daughter to see a psychiatrist or any other mental health provider unless mother obtained Dr. Mellon's approval. So that's my summary of the case. I see, actually, I don't know if the complainant is...
Yeah, the complainant.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, TK, thank you for being here. So TK, you may make a brief statement at this point, and then we'll see if we have any questions for you. Thank you.
I would like to make a exact the court order. So without approval of the Dr. Mellon, both parents not allowed to submit child to any counseling or any psychiatrist. And I filed many, many petitions with court and all was denied. And when we requested Dr. Mellon last year on July, when child starts show abnormal disruptive behavior, she gave us like a coworker, and she knows this coworker not going to take our case. So she made big delay in 4 months or 5 months until she made an October letter to her coworker. And next day, this letter was come back to both parents with a statement. This coworker, Ms. Cohen, I believe, she said she not take a child for the counseling. And then she gave us another lady, Brick, or some psychiatrist, which we called both parents for 3 months and nobody answered never. So technically, we got a psychiatrist only in Phoenix Children's Hospital on January 19, when child been in extremely critical condition with behavior health. And then child been delivered by 911 on April 22nd. Child been in hospital for mental behavior crisis on March 1st. On April 22nd, I have a statement, which is, it's 911. It's 911. Calls crisis neighbors. So child been delivered by department, emergency transportation, 911. So it's been extremely critical conditions. So on May 3rd, child attempted suicide, tried to jump out of the balcony and assaulted the crisis worker and police bin. It's been a serious police report. So she been delivered by transportation again, emergency to the Phoenix Children's Hospital, and she spent 8 days at the Phoenix Children's Hospital. So recently, on July 21st, we got support all diagnostics with very high level. I cannot tell diagnostic during this session, but it's very high level, very serious diagnostic. Definitely child at 11 attempt suicide. It's talk a lot. So it was very abusive of the power for Dr. Mellon. Not let us use 5 years, technically it was 5 years, any help, mental help for child, especially she knows it's been 2016 report and she had aware of this report. She knows it's been report from mental health. It's Arizona Children Association, which already had some diagnosis for the child. Child had very severe IEP since 2018. And Dr. Mellon many times called schools, different schools been changed. So it's cannot work in this point for Dr. Mellon was not aware. She constantly was talk with teacher in school. And right now, currently, child, according to IEP, she's 12 years old and she repeats the fifth grade because we didn't have help for her for previous years. And she show capability. She capable only make skills for first grade. At 12 years old, she not capable to read, she not capable to write, she incapable to taking care of herself, and it's a still ongoing mental crisis, and we didn't get any services. We not have no disability, also we in very critical situation with babysitters. She not capable to be any public school, she not allowed to have any babysitter, because any babysitter, all what have surrounded online, they said, oh, for this child need call 911. We not accept it. Never call us again. She not capable any caregiver, because caregiver said they not take the minors. So call special service, which is DDD. And we just recently, after Melmed applied for those DDD, also Melmed clinic, which is authorized for disability, she said child eligible for lifelong disability. So what disability mentally and intellectually she has, it's going to stay with her lifelong. And I believe our situation got worse with those action of Dr. Mellon, which prohibited us use support services, because if we've been 5 years ago, even maybe three 3 years ago, enroll in any services. It wasn't so crucial situation right now. It's, I believe it's never happened, 911 calls and emergency behavior. If child slowly get enrolled in counseling and psychiatrist and been and maybe hospitals and a special school. Now we try to enroll child to Lexington Autistic School because she's eligible, but it's very long process. We're not enrolled yet. We now kind of suffer with the online school, and I'm not a teacher. I'm not special ed teacher, and I don't have any family member who can help with teaching her or watching her. I cannot really work. I work only weekends when father watch child. And father cannot teach her. He missing all class with child. He not he's not capable to support her education because he don't understand how online classes work. So it's all on me, and I'm very very struggle with it. And I can say it's malpractice of Dr. Mellon. It's very serious. It's very serious.
Thank you, TK, for being here, and thank you for sharing that statement with us. Let me see if the committee members have any questions to ask you at this time. Hearing none, let's move on to Dr. Mellon, and I see she's present with her attorney, Mr. Beagley. Would
That's
you
correct.
Introduce yourselves, and you may make a statement, and then we'll ask you questions.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Stephen Beagley. I'm an attorney for Dr. Mellon. She also goes by Dr. Mellon Sissel. You pronounced it correctly. I'll let her introduce herself, and she has prepared a statement to try, which she anticipates will be around 5 minutes. But one thing I just wanted to note at the outset is that the claim by TK is associated with Dr. Mellon's court-ordered services. As you noted at the outset in providing your timeline, Dr. Mellon was appointed by the court as a therapeutic interventionist in May of 2016, and she continued in that role for a little over 3 years until September of 2019. And I mention this because the claims, allegations, and the background facts almost exclusively rely upon or reference events in 2021 and 2022 when Dr. Mellon was no longer the TI and no longer providing court-ordered services. And at that point, rather, Dr. Mellon was providing co-parenting services through a self-referral by mother and father. And as Dr. Mellon will explain, at the time of these complaints or the focus of the complaints in the claim, there were no court orders in place regarding restrictions for mother to bring daughter to a mental health provider. So it's against that backdrop that I think that the claim should be considered, which again was based on Dr. Mellon's court-ordered services.
Can I speak? Because it's been Dr. Mellon not allowed.
I'm sorry, TK. We will come back to you if the committee feels we need any more information from you. I apologize for that. Dr. Mellon, you may proceed with your statement.
Thank you. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to allow me to speak and supplement my June 3rd, 2022 written response to TK's claim against me that was associated again with my court orders services work with her and her family, and the opportunity to address two specific issues identified in the investigative report that the committee believes it warrants further investigation. In reviewing the investigative report, two issues are raised in the committee. The first one relating to Dr. Mellon prohibiting mother from taking her child to see a mental health professional here identified as a psychiatrist. The short answer to this is I did not prohibit mother from taking daughter to see any mental health provider. And to put that in context, a bit of background information may be helpful to better understand the issue. As previously mentioned, I was initially appointed as a TI, therapeutic interventionist, for the family in May of 2016. The court actually extended my term twice, in 2017 and again in 2018, wherein the third appointment ended on September 18, 2019. I just want to also explain that when the court ordered that I extend my appointment on September 18, 2018, they also gave either mother or father the opportunity to replace me in January of 2019, and neither parent chose to do that. Also, as I mentioned in my written response, this appointment was a bit more complicated than my usual role as a therapeutic interventionist for a family. Initially, I was asked to assist the family by reestablishing a relationship between the child and the father, where there had been a period of several months that the father and the child had not been together after there were allegations made in this case with regard to father's conduct with the child. Those allegations were not supported. Father and child were going to need to be reunited, and that's how I became involved. This was actually, this is a very difficult role. Therapeutic intervention role is a very hard role. Actually, it went quite well. And within the course of the first several months, father and child were reunited. Father and child went from supervised visits to the child being without supervision, and then gradually after my recommendation, the court ordered that the child could start spending time with father on a regular basis again. And I will have to say, after a short period of time, mother was supportive, and it's very important to have the aligned parent support this process, and mother did become supportive and helpful in this process. So I think it went quite well. Then, somewhat unexpectedly, at the court hearing in 2017, I was asked to continue in my role. I believe that the judge did this in part because the judge considered that this would perhaps be a way to help the parents be better able to communicate with one another, better able to reach agreements. The court filings and activities from 2011 up to this time there were hundreds of court filings. I will have to say, I think we were pretty successful with that. Actually, during the period of 2020 and 2021, there was not a single court filing. So moving forward, it's important that you also understand, as I looked at the concern that was raised, that I have to take direction from the court. And the direction that the court gave me with regard to serving as a gatekeeper was that the parents had come to an agreement, and the court ordered that neither parent could take the minor child to counseling without my approval. So to the extent that mother was prohibited from taking the daughter to see a mental health professional without my approval, this was in fact an order from the court. I did not, in my TI role, determined that that was something I wanted to do, or I expected the parents to follow that direction given by that I would be given. It was the court's order. And so moving forward, it's very important that if you look through my notes, and I don't know if you did or not, if you look through all of the emails that were sent, there were some 3,000 pages sent over to your offices. There was never a time that either mother or father, until 2021, made a request for mental health services for their child. As a matter of fact, I was given is information about the child's improvement in behavior, that she was getting along well with in school, getting along with friends, doing well at home. There would be occasions when her behavior was out of control, she'd be oppositional. The parents worked together with me in developing a behavioral management system. And I was told at several meetings over and over again by mother and father that these things were working when they were in place. Mother never made a request for a psychiatrist or psychologist to become involved during the entire term of my appointment. And then when the term of my appointment ended, a discussion about accessing a mental health professional didn't occur until about mid-2021. All right. I want to make sure. The other thing I think is important for me to point out is that actually our discussions about the needs for mental health counseling for the child were not, a referral was not requested. I was the I was, as a provider, recognize the need that we need to consider getting some counseling for this family and for these children and for this child at the home. So I did in 2021, when I saw that the child's was having maladaptive behavior was increasing and increasing rather quickly. I had concerns. There are a number of factors that were happening at that time for the child. She had been to several different schools. There was COVID. She had a primary attachment figure. Her older sister moved out. And I think the sister was also a big help to mom with taking care of the child. All these changes were occurring and things were getting very difficult for the child at that time. And it was time to get a counselor involved. And we discussed this in mid-2021, first time we did. But I'm going to call attention to the fact that we discussed it, but before that time, if either parent chose to access a mental health professional, they could do it without my support or my direction, but they chose not to. As a matter of fact, the parents, and particularly the mother, wanted to be able to continue to use a behavioral system. We used a token economy and we had behavior charts. And she would tell me the things that when she used this and she used some techniques that we had talked about, it made a difference in her daughter's behavior. The only potential referral to counseling that I noted in my records came about in 2017. And that was a recommendation I made specifically to mother, that she may want to consider counseling services in her parenting role. This discussion occurred during a co-parenting session on October 10th, 2017. I made that recommendation because mother had previously been in counseling at during the time of the marriage and seemed to have benefited from that counseling and medications that she took at that time. But in 2017, mother told me she was not going to go to counseling. She didn't believe that she needed it. And I did not believe that court-ordered counseling for mother would be particularly effective. So we moved on. Notes from August 2021 indicate that the parents
Dr. Mellon, I have to interrupt you here in the interest of time.
Okay.
I just have one or two questions to ask you. So what I'm hearing you say, and from what we have heard TK say, after September 2019, it was just a co-parenting counseling services that you were providing to TK and the father. And during that time, there seems to be some sort of a misunderstanding on TK's part as to whether the parents needed your approval to go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist for their daughter. And from your statement, it was helpful to me in terms of sort of like thinking about the timeline. It seems to me from what I've heard in 2017, you had recommended they take the daughter to see a psychologist. Am I hearing that right? Or
recommended who? Say that again, please.
In 2017, did you recommend or refer the parents to a psychologist to see the daughter?
I didn't make a specific referral. I spoke with mother during a session about getting some additional support. She was quite activated during that session. I had reviewed her history, and I felt that this might be an important time for her to consider support. She said she didn't want it and she didn't need it.
The confusion might be the referral was for mother to see, potentially seek counseling in her parenting role. The issue relating to the daughter and a potential referral to the daughter, not permission, this is a referral issue, those didn't come up for a couple of years after the court-appointed services timeframe had already passed.
Thank you. Yeah, and that was going to be my next question is, after the court order terminated in September of 2019, there was no requirement that any services to the daughter be approved by Dr. Mellon. Is that correct?
That's right. She did not need my approval. And at the beginning of my, in 2019, when it moved to my providing services not under appointment, we talked about the fact that no longer would there be, I would no longer be under appointment. I was not writing reports regularly to the court. Now they were here for co-parenting counseling, and that was a different, I was still going to be doing counseling, but she no longer needed my approval.
Thank you. That's all the questions that I had. Let me see if Dr. Mulata, Dr. Stewart has any questions. Dr. Stewart?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Dinar. My question, again, I think Dr. Mellon, you already answered Mr. Dinar. And so the parents did not need your approval after the termination of the of 2019, did not need your approval to seek a referral of either to a psychiatrist for medical issues or for counseling. Is that correct?
After my term ended in 2019, they did not.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, let's go into discussion and deliberation. Since I'm the lead on this case, I'll start the deliberation process. So this case was referred to the committee with the concern that there was some approval needed from Dr. Mellon to provide services for the daughter after the period of court appointment ended. And from what we heard today, I'm not seeing any reason to refer the case to the full board because I'm not seeing any unprofessional conduct violations or anything that comes close to it.
I agree. I move that we dismiss the case.
Second. There is a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion carries. Thank you, everyone, for being here for agenda item 4C. And now I'm in a fix.
Do we need to stay or can we drop off? Do we need to?
No, you can drop off. Yeah. Thank you for being
here. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And now I'm in a fix because we have one more item on the agenda and I have to get somewhere in about 10 minutes. So Ms. Galvin, do you have any recommendation? I mean, I think if there are two board members.
I'm actually recused from this case, Mr.
Dunn. Oh, that's right.
Oh, you are. Okay. Yes. So it appears then because of the recusal, we have lost quorum and the matter will have to be continued.
I don't believe we lost quorum. We have Dr. Stewart and Mr. Dinar. So,
well, Mr. Dinar is
going to need 5 minutes. And yeah, we can't start and then like stop in the middle of, you know.
Yeah, so we would
have to come back like in an hour if they can.
I don't know.
I have an ethics committee meeting that I belong to that will take probably 2 hours.
About that, I stepped out to use the restroom.
So I can propose that we can convene again maybe in 2.5 hours, like 1:30 p.m. if that's acceptable.
That would work for me.
Okay. Would that work for our staff? Would that work for our complainant, etc.? I mean, all of the parties who need to be present.
There is no complainant, so it would just be Dr. McGady and his attorney to determine if they're available at that time. I'm sorry, Jean, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I just wanted to make sure Farron and Dr. McGady were available. I have a 1 o'clock, but I can move that.
So shall we then reconvene at 1:30 p.m.? Just that?
1:30. I would like to take just a brief recess that I can consult with my client about this, if that would be okay with you all.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. If we can just take a momentary break, I'm going to use my cell phone, connect with him, and then come right back onto the Zoom program, okay?
All right, and I will mute both of you. At this time.
So since I am recused, is it okay if I leave the meeting?
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Malat. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Malat.
Okay, thank you.
Bye, Ramona.
Bye-bye.
lead on this case?
We have to wait for Dr. Aikens to be
okay.
There.
We've discussed the issue, and the client's decision is that he'd like to go ahead and try and take care of the matter today. And I'm hearing that that may be a really good thing, given that otherwise this is going to be continued until October. So at this point, let's do plan to go ahead and suspend discussion right now. And if you would, just let us know officially when you want us to return, and we'll see to it that that happens.
Thank you, Dr. Aikens, and thank you for accommodating us. I know it's rather unusual, and I appreciate that. So I'm hearing that maybe 1:30 p.m. works for both me and Dr. Stewart and our staff at the board. So we would reconvene at 1:30 p.m. today. Thank you, Dr. Aikens. Until then, we are adjourned.
We're recessed.
May I just add to this that my plans are such that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to attend by Zoom. It'll depend on whether or not I'm tech savvy enough to figure out how to do that on my cell phone. But if I'm not, I'll certainly call in, and I will be on my cell phone for just this part of today's meeting. So don't be concerned. I'll be there, but it may just be by telephone.
Thank you, Dr. Aikens, for the heads up. Yeah, we'll miss seeing you, but that's fine.
And you have the call-in information, Dr. Aikens. It's the same as what I think.
You did. Thank you.
All right. See you at 1:30.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, I think we have everybody. Let's get started. I want to start first by saying I want to thank everyone for their flexibility. I know we had to take a recess, so I'm just glad that it worked out for everyone. The time is now 1:32 p.m., and we're back from the recess of the Board of Psychologist Examiners Complaint Screening Committee. So the only case remaining on the agenda is Item 4D, which is case number 22-34 for David Gady.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, can we note that Dr. Stewart and Mr. Dinar are present? Ramona Malott is not. She's recused from this matter. Farron Aikens, Dr. McCady are present as well, our staff and myself. We have a quorum.
Thank you for that clarification. Yeah, we do have quorum with myself and Dr. Stewart present. So for case number 22-34, Dr. Stewart, would you please get us started?
Yes. Thank you. This complaint is from the Complaint Screening Committee that met April 19th, 2022. And it viewed a person associated with Dr. McGady, who has since, I believe, made an agreement with the board for corrective action. Can I mention that person's name in the? Okay, thank you. So Janet Higgins was employed by Dr. McGady's firm as an independent psychologist, held a license at an independent level of practice. And during an investigation of an evaluation that she had committed herself to and had completed, the Complaint Screening Committee had some concerns that they wanted to address with Dr. McGady. I understand these concerns to be thus. The report was lacking essential content, one. Two, Dr. Higgins did not interview all applicable collateral, such as the child's father, and she performed an evaluation in an area that appears to be outside of her competence. And the third item was Dr. Higgins agreed to perform the evaluation when assigned by the agency for whom she works, in a contracted capacity, despite not having previous experience conducting evaluations for families engaged in contentious family court proceedings. And so during that complaint and investigation of Dr. Higgins, Dr. McGady's name came up. Dr. McGady responded very quickly and indicated that it has been brought to the agency's attention that a formal complaint has been filed against Dr. Higgins. Upon review of the complaint, the agency has conducted an internal audit and review of the breadth of Dr. Higgins' work. Based on the extent of the internal review, it is believed that Dr. Higgins' report was found to be deficient according to agency standards. And it goes on from there. There was a corrective behavioral part to the letter to the board, which has been implemented by Dr. McGady. And so those are basically the, as I understand it, the facts in the case and the allegations. Being the lead, I guess maybe I'll start with some ideas involved or.
Dr. Stewart, so let's first hear from Dr. McGady and Dr. Akins, and then we can ask questions and kind of carry it forward. So Dr. McGady, Dr. Akins, if you want to make a statement, and I'm sure we'll have questions to ask you.
Yeah, definitely.
Hang on a second. Just for the record, I'm counsel for the licensee. This is Dr. Farron Akins. I'll let Dr. McGady introduce himself. He has some comments he'd like to share with you. I have a couple of legal points I'd like to point out. So thanks.
I'm Dr. David McGady. I'm the licensed psychologist that the board opened the investigation in. I wanted to thank you for allowing me to address the concerns the board expressed with regard to the evaluation that was conducted through my agency by Dr. Higgins. At the time of the complaint, Dr. Higgins worked as an independent contractor. She was not an employee. As such, she had complete control of her schedule. She could accept or refuse any evaluations offered, and she received a 1099. She never indicated any concerns about accepting the evaluation underlying the complaint. Board regulations and the APA ethics code don't really mention much about supervision of an independent contractor. What is discussed is the oversight of employees, trainees, interns, and residents. I contracted Dr. Higgins to conduct evaluations as an independent contractor in part because she did not appear to have a need for supervision and presented as an evaluator, as an experienced evaluator. She was licensed in Washington State for 10 years, where she did extensive evaluations and held her own provider contract with a local Department of Child Safety. In Arizona, while employed at my agency, she conducted over 100 evaluations, 48 of them being referred by the Department of Child Services here in Arizona. She additionally testified as a mental health expert in DCS court in both Maricopa and Pinal counties. Nothing that Dr. Higgins reported to me about the evaluation in question indicated there was anything significantly different about from the other evaluation she accepted. She didn't ask me of any or anyone else at the agency for consultation regarding this case. With regard to the case, the parents being involved in a highly contentious divorce or custody case, there's nothing in the referral form or the referral information that indicates this. Neither the referral form or the unit summary provided by the consulting psychologist indicated the presence of a highly contentious divorce or custody issue. I find it notable that only 40 pages of the records were sent with the referral information. And then when the complaint was filed against Dr. Higgins, it was revealed that actually 600 pages of the records were in existence. This is only about 6% of the total file. After the complaint with Dr. Higgins was filed, we conducted an internal audit, placed her on a corrective action plan, and converted her to an employee so that she could be supervised. I've also taken steps to convert all of the clinical personnel at my agency over to employees to increase the oversight and the supervision. One of the things we've done is we conduct monthly audits, and I've hired a forensic psychologist to do those outside of myself. And she regularly audits the work product for all the agency's personnel. I review the feedback. I get the audit reports the third week of the month. I review them, add my own comments, and then we review them with the clinical staff. And then those are scanned into their personnel files. I hope you were able to review the letter that I sent detailing that process, as well as the blank auditing form, so you can see exactly what we're looking for. And as well as Dr. Higgins' report or audit, most recent audit before she resigned. Thank you for letting me speak to the committee today. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
And I'll just follow up then with giving you a citation in case you want to go and check this out. But under the board's rules, here's the rule number, R4-26-101B36. This is the one in the rule section that defines supervise. And actually what it specifically states is supervise means, quote, to control, oversee, and review the activities of an employee, intern, trainee, or resident who provides psychological services. So notice it specifically does not call out independent contractor. I will tell you that as an attorney that provides consultation to licensees all the time, this is a common area of confusion about what in the world is the difference between an employee and an independent contractor. What can I do with each in terms of reviewing their work product and giving them specific direction? Well, really, the answer is if you've got an independent contractor, not much. Because the general area of employment law, tax law, and civil law all point out that independent contractors, unlike employees, have scheduling freedom, are considered self-employed with freedom to work with others, may accept or decline projects, can determine for themselves the manner and method of doing work, and decide their work location. So it's pretty hard if you're going to contract with somebody as an independent contractor to expect the level of oversight that I read between the lines on the complaint regarding Dr. McGady. So keeping that in mind, whether you agree or disagree, certainly this gentleman has gone out of his way to rectify whatever concerns you may have had with regard to the operation of independent contractors versus employees, because he switched everybody over to being an employee of the agency, set up an auditing system, and is really has made a valiant effort, I believe, to comply in a way that will keep everybody supervised. So thanks. We're certainly available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart, do you have any questions to ask at this time?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Dinar. Dr. McGady, so when Dr. Higgins came to work in your agency, you knew that she was licensed at an independent level and that she had more than 10 years of experience doing evaluations and for a child for the Department of Child Services?
Yes, sir.
That was
a big part of why I hired her. We have grown fairly fast as an agency, and I was looking for somebody that could conduct evaluations independently that I wouldn't have to have a great deal of oversight on.
And she was a 1099 employee?
Yes, sir.
Good. Thank you.
So at this time, I do not have any questions. So I suppose that concludes our part where we hear from the licensee. Dr. Stewart, do you want to now get into deliberations?
Yes, I really am hard pressed to see where Dr. McGady would interfere in the work product of an independently licensed person. Certainly if he had known beforehand that there was going to be some deficiencies in interviewing, such as not interviewing one party, then that may have been something. But in reading Dr. McGady's response, he was kind of expecting that a standard policy for doing evaluations would be followed, which would include at least interviewing all parties that had a common interest. And I think that he was as surprised by that not being the case as what anyone else would be. So I can't see any professional malpractice. I cannot see any aberrant professional practice going on.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. And that was my assessment as well. And, there is certainly a difference between supervising independent contractors and supervising employees, trainees, residents, et cetera. So that distinction is clear here from the submissions that we have received and from what we have heard today. So I'm leaning toward dismissing the matter. That's what I'm hearing. So I guess I can make that a motion.
I second that motion.
All right. There's a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion carries. So I think that concludes all of the cases on our agenda. I move to adjourn today's complaint screening committee meeting. Is there a second?
Second.
There's a motion and a second.
Sorry, I have a question.
Let's finish. The matter that you were here on has already concluded. If you have a question, you can contact staff. So we're going to finish this motion to adjourn.
So there is a motion on the table. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion carries. We are adjourned. It's 1:47.